Hello again. Please continue to enjoy your lunch as I introduce today's guest. Thank you. Tom Brokaw began his journalism career in 1962 at KMTV in Omaha, Nebraska. He anchored the late evening news on Atlanta's WSB-TV in 1965. Before joining KNBC-TV in Los Angeles. He was hired by NBC News in 1966, and from 1976 to 1981, he anchored the Today Show. During his tenure as anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News, Tom Brokaw became one of the most trusted and respected figures in broadcast journalism. He stepped down after 21 years at the anchor desk, but continues to produce documentaries and provide expertise for NBC. In 1998, Brokaw added best-selling author to his resume by writing The Greatest Generation. Inspired by the mountain of mail he received from his first book, Brokaw wrote The Greatest Generation Speaks in 1999. He then followed up with An Album of Memories and A Long Way From Home. His new book, Boom, Voices of the 60s, is number 2 on the bestseller list. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tom Brokaw.
Thank you all very much. It's always a pleasure to come back to Atlanta. I never fail on that final glide pattern as we land at the airport to think about the first time that I arrived here. I was called by Ray Moore. Some of you in the room will remember who he was. I was working in Omaha doing the early morning news 5 days a week, working Saturday nights doing the 6 and 10 for the grand sum of $110 a week. And there was a ferocious blizzard that had swept across the Midwest. I had a broken foot from playing in club basketball games on Friday nights. And Ray invited me to come to Atlanta and interview for the 11 o'clock news. My wife was persuaded that they wouldn't hire me because, with my foot in a cast, she was sure that they would think I was an accident risk of some kind. Nonetheless, I arrived in Atlanta late March, one of those kind of early, balmy, beautiful spring Atlanta evenings, and I told the taxi driver that I was going to WSB in those days, and he said, "White columns on Peachtree, yes, sir." And as we drove up, I could almost hear the soundtrack from Gone with the Wind playing in the background. And I walked in and I thought, God, if I don't get this job, I'm going to become an atheist. So that's our deal. I did get the job. I was 25 years old and a Yankee. I don't know what the hell they were thinking when they hired me, to tell you the truth, but it became really one of the most important stops, not only in my professional life, but in our personal lives as well, because we came to know Atlanta, and we got to know much more about the South, these two pilgrims from the Great Plains, and that was very important to us. Now, to tell you just how uninformed we were about the South, on the first Sunday that we were here, Ray Moore and his wife picked us up to take us to church. And as we came out, my wife said to Ray, "I'm sorry, but what kind of tree is that?" And he looked at her with an expression of utter incredulity, and he said, "Well, darling, that's a magnolia." But we quickly adapted and learned the difference between Houston and Houston, the difference between hay and high, and it may look like it is Taliaferro County, but it's Tolliver County. I still remember. And I made lasting friendships and got to know this remarkable region and this great city, and it served me well all these years. And in my own memory bank now, I have still fixed one of the great short interviews and responses I've ever heard. You may remember that in 1966, a philosopher at Emory University had written a paper asking the question, "Is God dead?" And it was on the cover of Time magazine. And there was in Atlanta at that time one of the greatest reporters I'll ever encounter. His name was Aubrey Morris. He did radio on WSB. He was utterly ubiquitous. He was everywhere with his microphone and fearless. And the week that this Time magazine cover came out asking the question, is God dead? Billy Graham came to town. And when he got off the plane, Aubrey rushed up to him with his microphone extended and said, Dr. Graham, is God dead? Dr. Graham, that at the peak of his personal and spiritual powers, drew himself up and he said, why, of course not. And Aubrey very quickly said, how do you know? And the single greatest response to that kind of a question I've ever heard came from Dr. Graham, who said, because I spoke with him this morning. So I have all those fond memories of Atlanta, and they help frame this latest project in which I have been involved, called Boom, Voices of the 60s, because Atlanta was part of my own personal and professional pilgrimage from a child of the 1950s on the Great Plains and working class communities, working in Omaha and then in Atlanta. And then not too long after I had been here, NBC came calling. And the fact is, I turned them down the first time. They wanted me to go to Los Angeles and join the NBC News Bureau, and I went out there and looked around, and I thought, you know, I like Atlanta better. I'm going to stay there. They thought I was a very canny negotiator. Fact is, I just wanted to stay in Atlanta. And so they came back with the salary of the likes of which I thought no person could possibly earn at my age and many more opportunities. And so I said yes, and we left here and arrived in Southern California in 1966. In 1963, I was working in Omaha, still this innocent from the small towns of South Dakota, when the bells went off on the wire machine on a November day. And I read the wires in disbelief. Shots been fired at the presidential motorcade. The president was gravely, perhaps mortally wounded. I jumped in the car, raced out to the Strategic Air Command headquarters to see if they were on extra alert, and began to talk to myself aloud, saying, this does not happen in America. This romantic, idealized figure, John F. Kennedy, who had changed the face of American politics so profoundly, now murdered. And I remember thinking, this will change us. I wasn't sure how, but I thought we would become a different country in some fashion. And it was, I think, the beginning of the 1960s, as we now measure them. So when I arrived in Southern California in 1966, there were great cross currents in the land. Here in the South, of course, you were in the midst of one of the greatest moral crusades in any country's history, led by Dr. Martin Luther King, a native son, who gave voice to the oppressed in America. In his eloquence and in his commitment to nonviolence, he moved a nation, helped in large part, as Andy Young and others will tell you, by the arrival of network television news, which was a recent phenomenon in those days, and it linked the country. So those of us who lived in Omaha, or if you lived in Chicago, you could see firsthand what was happening. There was a drawback to some of that, of course, that meant that we were focused on the South and not enough on the de facto segregation of the industrial North. And so the country was moving in terms of racial equality and beginning to address it both legally and in a personal way and in a moral way. But there were other winds that were beginning to blow. Black nationalists were coming into the movement. And in California, an actor whose career in movies and even on television had already peaked decided that he would run for governor of the state. And he would take an entirely different tack as a Republican, as a conservative, and as someone who spoke for what later came to be called the silent majority, and that was Ronald Reagan. By 1967, I'm in San Francisco a lot because Berkeley is blowing up almost every day. I come back one night, into the city, and the cab driver says, "What do you do, mister?" And I said, "I'm a journalist." He said, "Do you know about this neighborhood called Haight-Ashbury?" And in my trench coat and button-down white shirt and narrow tie, I went to Haight-Ashbury. Honest to God, I looked like a narc. But no one seemed to care. It was the summer of peace and love, and it was like stepping into the bar scene in Star Wars. I had never seen anything quite like it. Love beads, bongo drums, drugs everywhere. Janis Joplin lived on one corner. The Grateful Dead lived on another corner. And young members of the baby boomer generation were pouring in to that neighborhood from all over the country. Some of them in pretty wrecked condition physically. And they were pushing back. Now, I have a little metaphor for the fall of 1967, which was really prologue for what happened in 1968. I try to summarize now to my own grandchildren and my own children about what it was like in a lot of families in this country. And here's my construct. I say, try to imagine somebody who grew up in Upper Michigan or in the piney woods of Alabama or in Georgia during the Depression. They were 17 in 1938. They'd had to drop out of school in the eighth grade to put food on the family's table, and they had to share shoes with brothers and work two jobs just to keep things going. And then the war breaks out and they join the Marines. This man does. And he fights on Iwo Jima and Okinawa and Bougainville. And he survives and he comes back, and there are unparalleled opportunities for someone like him. He gets some training because of the GI Bill and marries his old high school sweetheart. And they move to Detroit, and he gets a very good job on the assembly line at the Ford Motor Company, where they're paying top wages. His pension is vested. He has full health benefits. And his family begins to think in new ways, and he begins to think in new ways, but he stays in his old culture. He keeps the crew cut, goes to the American Legion a couple nights a week, and he's got life pretty well figured out. He runs a very paternalistic household. And one night, late in the fall of 1967, this man comes home from the job with his lunchbox, getting ready to go to the Legion, sits down at the dinner table, and there's a startling sight just across from him. There is his daughter, who's decided that leg hair is a fashion statement, that women, to get rid of oppression, no longer have to shave their legs. She's in a loose blouse with no brassiere, holding hands with what appears to be her boyfriend, but he can't be sure because he has hair down to here and sunglasses on. And she says, "Daddy, Zeke and I are moving in together. But don't worry about it. I'm on the pill. It'll be okay." Now, looking for some relief, he shifts his attention to his son, who has even longer hair, and a T-shirt made of an American flag with a swastika on it. And he says, "Pop, I figured out how to get out of the draft. And if I don't, I'm heading to Canada and I'm going to become a citizen there." Now, this man is reeling. He turns to his wife, 22 years. And she's standing in the kitchen with her hands on their hips. And she says, "Hey, big guy, how come I'm the only one who does the dishes in this household?" That's kind of a compressed metaphor for what was going on in this country. There was an enormous pushback on the part of this largest, best educated, wealthiest generation any society had ever produced, the boomers. There was a war going on in Southeast Asia. In fact, before I left Atlanta in 1966, they had a huge rally at the baseball park called Affirmation Vietnam. It was in support the war in Vietnam. By 1967, grave doubts had begun to set in across the political and cultural landscape in this country. And on a Sunday dinner in California, through a mutual friend, I spent a lot of time with Gene McCarthy. And it was beginning to be clear that he was thinking about doing something personally dramatic as a statement of his opposition to the war, but we didn't know that he was prepared to challenge the sitting president of the United States from his own party, Lyndon Johnson, who had crushed Barry Goldwater just 3 years earlier. And so 1968 arrives. And seldom in our country's history has there been one year quite like that one. McCarthy does run. Clean gene, kind of small college professor type, who goes from door to door in New Hampshire and comes within 7 points of the sitting president of the United States and effectively forces him from office. In March of that year, the Tet Offensive occurs in Vietnam. Viet Cong troops invade not just Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam. They get into the embassy grounds and into the embassy itself of the United States of America. And despite all the assurances that the war was going well, America was now even more unsettled about the wisdom of that war and the consequences of it. Bobby Kennedy has now gotten into the political race. He was known before primarily as the ruthless enforcer of the Kennedy family political machine. But he'd become a much more existential man as a result of his brother's death and what he had been seeing in Appalachia, the Deep South, and on Indian reservations in my native state of South Dakota. And this dialogue in the Democratic Party began and didn't end in the first 2 months of the year. It went on all the way to June. But of course, before we got to June, Dr. King had gone to Memphis, Tennessee to stand with sanitation workers. He had the Poor People's Campaign underway trying to get economic as well as racial justice in America. He was being challenged as well by the likes of H. Rapp Brown and Stokely Carmichael for the putative leadership of the racial civil rights campaign in this country. And a shot rang out, and he was killed instantly. Just 24 hours later, just 24 hours earlier, he had said to his gathered disciples, "I have seen the promised land." And across America, including here in Atlanta, so many neighborhoods went up in utter rage, striking back against the loss of this great leader. So the country was roiled by violence and conflict in the streets and in a far-off war where more and more young Americans were dying every week. And on the political stage, at the same time, came striding a man who in 1962 had taken himself out of national politics, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And he began to put together a new Republican Party that paid less attention to the moderates in the Northeast and much more to the conservatives coming out of the Mountain West and the Southwest, and looking to your region as well to pick up a new constituency that was disenchanted with what they were seeing in the streets and uncomfortable with what had happened in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act. And then in June, Bobby Kennedy, Ambassador Hotel, won a narrow but an important victory over Lyndon Johnson. There is the possibility that he can get the nomination if he can get to Chicago. And he says at the Ambassador Hotel podium, "On to Chicago," and moments later, he too is dead. I've talked to a number of young people who were 8 and 9 at the time, and they said because these were their first experiences with life, they believed that our political leaders just routinely got murdered. Stop and think about that. They were 5 and 6 when President Kennedy was killed. And then, of course, it was just 5 years later when Dr. King was killed. Bobby Kennedy was killed. Going to Chicago, we have riots in the streets. The FDR coalition begins to unravel. Republicans get their act together and begin to move in, as I say, on new regions, new territory for them. At the same time, out of the South, in your neighboring state, Governor Wallace runs as an independent candidate, effectively, with a message of hate, fear, and economic populism. And between them, that fall, despite all the demonstrations in the streets and the appearance that the country was moving sharply left, that fall, 60% of the people who went to the polls voted for either George Wallace or for Richard Nixon. There was, in fact, a silent majority. There was a pushback, people hanging on to their traditional views and their traditional values. America was more deeply divided that year than at any other time that I can remember, and those divisions set in and we're still dealing with them. In 1972, man from my home state, George McGovern, ran on a strong anti-war platform. But the perceptions of his campaign were defined at the edges and in the margins of it. The more radical elements that attached themselves to George McGovern's campaign, and he was crushed by Richard Nixon. What he didn't know at the time is that the White House had something called the Plumber's Operation. They'd broken in to a Democratic Party headquarters office in the Watergate Hotel. And we began another long, difficult, emotional, political roller coaster called Watergate, which before it was over, was one of the great constitutional crises in American history. And Richard Nixon resigned the office of the presidency in the summer of 1974. And the presidency passed to Gerald R. Ford, a decent man from the Midwest, more moderate Republican. I remember my father saying, he makes his own English muffins in the morning. He's my kind of guy. It's the first Republican my father ever had any good things to say about. And I knew that the country felt better about where they were going and how they were going to get there. So I marked that the end of the 1960s. Now, the legacy of the 60s is that we are more politically divided in so many ways. Both parties, at the national level, have gone to the far corners of the room, philosophically and ideologically. There has been too little attempt to find common ground. Republican and Democratic senators alike, everyone from Al Simpson to Bob Kerrey, who left the Senate voluntarily, say they don't want to work in a city, in a system, where there's no real effort at compromise anymore. But there have been enormous gains as well. This room is a portrait of those gains. The gender diversity and the racial diversity here, represented not just in your attendance, but in the institutions that you represent and the positions that you hold in them. So those gains are to be applauded and to be built on. We were left, however, at the same time, with a drug culture that was treated lightly and romantically. There was recreational drug use. It may come as a surprise to some of you, but in this book I disclosed for the first time, I too inhaled. I'm interested that you're applauding. I don't know what that says. Maybe we ought to go into your background a little more. But I decided that I'm still a child of whiskey and good red wine. But now we have, as you know, a drug culture in this country, a vast criminal empire. And it's a cancer on our most needy neighborhoods in the inner city across America, wherever you are, and in the American West, where I spent a lot of time. Methamphetamines now are another kind of cancer eating away, and we have not really addressed how we're going to deal with this drug culture that can be so corrosive for all of us. What did take root in the 60s was the idea that if you had an interest, you could organize your life around it. Good news and bad news. Good news in that a lot of interests that had been overlooked, everything from gay rights to the evangelical movement to the environmental movement, got its way onto the screen. Unfortunately, in too many cases, that became the single prism through which people involved in those interests saw life. And that became their litmus test for determining the worth of a candidate who came before them. And as a result, we have a political arena with far too many niches, in my judgment, and too few people who are willing to stand and say, I can't agree with you on everything, but I promise you that in my public service, I will represent your best collective interest and find a way to move this country forward. If there is a solution and it comes from a conservative, I don't care. If it's the solution, that's what I'm interested in. If there's a solution and it comes from a liberal, I don't care about the liberal label. I'm interested in the effect of the solution. And so I hope before this next year is out, 2008, we'll have a kind of national referendum, if you will, on the 60s. will finally decide what's worth keeping and what should be left behind. One of the people that I interview in the book and appears on the History Channel documentary this Sunday night is Arlo Guthrie. He's one of two who sum up the 60s pretty well. Arlo says, it's a good thing the 60s are still controversial. It means nobody's lost yet. Bill Clinton says, if you thought the 60s were good, you're probably a Democrat. If you thought they were bad, you're probably a Republican. And that's been kind of the reaction to my book as well, people picking out those parts that work for them and those parts that they deeply disagree with. Now let me just take the concluding few moments and give you a few of my thoughts on the profession for which this meeting is named, the press. These are challenging times. Our business is changing at warp speed. I have never seen anything like this in my lifetime in terms of the possibilities, but also the perils of this new universe that we're creating. I call it the second Big Bang. We're trying to determine which of these many planets that are afloat out there will support life, which ones will collide with others and destroy each other, which ones will drift too close to the sun, and where is the sun, and what will it warm? So as we work our way through those delivery systems and wonder about the future of so many of the traditional media that we have all grown up with, I think it's important to keep one thing in mind, that for as long as mankind has been around, from the time that cavemen used sharpened charcoal sticks to write on cave walls, it is the content and the organization of it that requires courageous journalists of integrity and objectivity that serves the Democratic Republic well. We'll work our way through the delivery systems at some point. We'll begin to sort out what works best, and new generations will be able to adapt, as well as older generations, to these new systems of delivery. But what will not go away will be the need for a place for a society and its members to get reliable information. It is the oxygen of democratic systems of government, and we cannot forget that. I was at the Washington Post the other day waiting for an appointment. I was standing in the lobby, and they have a wonderful display about their very modern printing press. 75,000 copies an hour, four or five different editions, ending at 2:15 in the morning. The ink rolls are changed automatically, the large cylinders. And I was quite bedazzled by that. I have written a lot for print. I've never worked at a newspaper per se, but I've written a lot for the Post and the New York Times and the LA Times and others. And I kind of have my nose still pressed up against that window, looking in and thinking, what a marvel. And then I had this disquieting thought. If I come back here in 10 years, will I have to go to the Smithsonian to see that printing press? Will it all be digital? And how do we adapt to a digital means of retrieving news? And I thought, this is going to require the best attention of all of us, journalists and consumers of news alike. And so my parting words are to the journalists and others who are gathered here representing other interests. I think that going into 2008, it's probably appropriate for all of us to re-enlist again, to re-up as citizens and as journalists. There are new challenges ahead. It's going to require the best effort of all of us. Thank you all very much. So the dogs are going to be in the Sugar Bowl, right? Let me tell you how I have lived all these years on the dogs. I've only seen one game, but it turns out, quite by a lot of the good fortune that has followed Tom and Meredith Brokaw around, that we were given tickets to a game in the fall of 1965. It was Vince Dooley's first year as the head football coach. They were playing at home against the tide, the number one team in the country. Our tickets happen to be, I know this is why we got them, on the Alabama side. So we sat just in front of the Alabama band. You know what that would be like. And in the middle of a lot of burly fans who literally had red necks. And they treated us courteously when they understood that we were Georgia fans, sort of like survivors of a car wreck. They were there to help us through the afternoon. I don't know how many of you remember that specific game. Georgia wins on a last-second flea flicker and going for two. And the place went nuts. So whenever I go to Alabama and they begin to puff up a little bit about the Tide, I always say, you know, I've only seen the Tide play one time. You can quiet an entire auditorium in Alabama with that comment. We have some questions, Mark?
We do. Here's the first. What do you recall about JFK's speech on his Catholic faith? And how do you feel about Mitt Romney making a similar speech today?
Yeah. I wish I had seen the speech today. I was very curious about it. I think he had to address it. I was in Louisville last week working on something else that a lot of you are probably familiar with, the emerging church within the evangelical movement, young people splitting off from the mega churches, starting smaller churches to address their personal concerns. They're apolitical in many ways. And so as part of that series, I went to Louisville to interview the head of the Baptist Theological Seminary there, Dr. Moeller. And he plainly was very unsettled by the idea of Mitt Romney doing well and needed to hear more from him. I'm not sure he can be persuaded, by the way, because he just said he didn't think it was a good idea for the United States to have a Mormon in the White House. I'm sorry, what was the first half of the question?
What do you recall about JFK's speech, and how do you feel about Romney's
well,
speech?
Well, I do remember this about JFK's speech. It was a different Catholic church, for one thing, in those days. You know, it was a they were still doing Latin masses. It was more mystical in many ways. It was not nearly as open or ecumenical in terms of how it welcomed people. I grew up in a little town in South Dakota where there was a very strong Catholic population. We had a Monsignor, and I was dating a Catholic girl who went to the Catholic high school, and before I could take her to the Catholic dance, I had to get permission from him. We couldn't be in each other's weddings. You know, my friends were Catholics. I was the only Protestant on the basketball team on the starting five, so I ate more bad whitefish all one winter than any other time in my life, because on Fridays they ate fish. So it was a different church in those days. And John Kennedy was not just about his Catholicism, but in our part of the world, out in the suspicious Great Plains, who was this very wealthy guy and who had never worked a day in his life, and the presumption that he might want to be president. So I think that the speech was critically important. I remember when he gave it, and it did, I think, erase a lot of the questions and opposition to him, but it was still there. Now, if you'll give me another 30 seconds, I'll tell you a little inside baseball story. Teddy White wrote about that campaign. It was a famous book, The Making of the President. And the key campaign, primary in that campaign, was in West Virginia. A deeply Baptist church, very suspicious of the Roman Catholic Church and the Vatican and the Pope. And I was at a dinner one night with Teddy many years later in which he was saying how moved he was by seeing these West Virginia Baptists really, during the course of that campaign, develop a tolerance for someone who happened to be a Roman Catholic from a big city in the Northeast. And when he finished this kind of very emotional outpouring, Abe Ribicoff, who was the late senator from Connecticut, was a key figure of the Kennedy campaign, had lowered his head during the course of this this little speech from Teddy. And finally, he raised it up and he said, Teddy, it had nothing to do with tolerance. We bought and paid for that state four times.
What was your exact quote about egg on our face after the 2000 elections? And has the media recovered from that mistake?
Yeah, I think we have. I'll never trust another exit poll as long as I live. You know, we had a bad patch again in 2004. I'm one who doesn't believe that we ought to be going there. It was different when we first started making these calls off exit polls. This is a lot of inside baseball for you. We did it first in 1980. And what happened over the course of a long period of time, I think the voters began to push back and reject it. They didn't tell us exactly what they had done. We had, in this last election, they had very young people out there asking how they had voted. Older folks didn't want to share that information with younger people. So we got some terrible misreads. And what we're going to have to do is have a kind of a larger framework of how we determine that. If it were left to me, I would change the election procedure entirely. I would have us start voting across the nation, all the time zones, on Friday at about 6 p.m. Eastern time. So it's, 11 in the morning in Hawaii? And that goes on until 6 p.m. Eastern time Sunday night, all weekend. And you've got an electronic card, you can vote at the football stadium or at the Super Bowl, at the supermarket or at the mall. These are all code. We trust them with our expense accounts and we trust them with our charge accounts. Why can't we trust them with our vote? We can't get any access to any of this all weekend long, those of us in the press. Polls close simultaneously on Sunday night, 6. We've had 48 hours to vote. And then the country finds out by electronic calculation 30 minutes later, and we all find out at the same time. You could organize election parties around the country. People would be more inclined to vote if that were the case. But the difficulty is, of course, that the voting procedures in America are controlled by the secretaries of state in every individual state. And, of course, they have partisan interests that they're constantly trying to protect. I think it's fairly outrageous how broken our voting system is. That's an extreme example of what I would do, but there are a lot of other things that need to be done so that we have more confidence in the procedure.
What's the legacy of the Bush administration as 2008 election?
Well, the legacy for the 2008 election is that they are going to be the issue. This is going to be an election about what's happened in the last 8 years. And whether your view is it's good, bad, or indifferent, the president bet his presidency on Iraq. That was effectively the sole issue and the defining issue of this administration for the last 8 years. Now, having said that, I know personally that the president believes that he ultimately will be redeemed by history. And it may take a while, that he believes 25, 30, 40 years from now, you'll have a much more stable Middle East and democratic republics out there as a result of the action that he has taken now. But that's what's going to be in play this time, is the Bush administration. Same time, numbers are way down. The new Democratic Congress, their numbers are even lower. People are pushing back hard against the national political system. Well, let me just put a little formula before you. Billy Payne was the chairman of the Atlanta Olympics. He's now the president of Augusta. You think I'm going to take on Billy Payne under those circumstances? Well, the best one for me was Sydney. Australia really turned itself inside out. And it was a lot of fun. I had a great time here in Atlanta. You had difficulties. You all know that. And the bombing was a central part of that, but there were other difficulties as well. But Sydney was phenomenal. I mean, the Aussies down under had it really well organized. The weather was fantastic. And one of the reasons it worked well for me is that I was working at the opposite end of the clock. It was 13-hour time difference, so I was going on the air early in the morning there. So I had to get up at 4:30 or 5 and go do the news. Then I'd have all day to go to events. So those were great Olympics. One of my oldest friends was Rayford Johnson, who was a famous decathlon athlete, won the gold in 1960, was on Bobby Kennedy's side when he was assassinated. His daughter was an Olympic volleyball player, And so she became like our daughter. I mean, that's as close as I'm ever going to get to having an Olympian. And so we would go with Rafer and Betsy to every match out of Bondi Beach and had a great time and felt really connected to it. What I remember about Atlanta, I actually do have a good story about Atlanta. When Carl Lewis unexpectedly won the long jump, it was a great moment. And I knew him and I called him up and I said, Carl, this is the next day. We're going to do a big story about you tonight on Nightly News. And he said, okay, but it's madness. You're going to have to pick me up. And we're down in Peachtree Street somewhere and get me to where you want to do this. And we have to do it fast because people will congregate. So I picked him up, got him down, masses of people. We held him back long enough for me to finish the interview, threw him into a van to get him out of there. He had ridden over there in our car. And then I had this young high school driver working for me, and he drives me back to the NBC site. And when we're driving back, there's this ping, ping in the car, and it's not, the doors are closed, and we've all got our seat belts on. I go up to the office, and I say to the kid, find out where that ping is coming from. He comes up about, 10 minutes later. His eyes are about this big around. He said, it's Carl Lewis's cell phone. It's in this bag. And I said, oh, well, we'll get it back to him. He said, that's not all. The gold medal's in the bag. I said, okay, Christmas cards, everybody. And I had my entire staff line up, put the gold medal on. Took pictures of it. After I finished, I called Carl, and I said, Carl, we've got it. Oh, thank God, he said. And I said, it's going to be in a lot of Christmas cards this year, Carl. We still laugh about it when we see each other. So that was a good moment.
Why is the generation that gave us civil rights and women's liberation not
integrated? It may be before it's all over. I keep saying history has not made its final judgment on it. One of the reasons the greatest generation was, and I used that, I was the one who came up with that proclamation. People have challenged it, and I just say to them simply, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. That was a more homogenous generation. They went through the Depression kind of collectively and then through a war in which everyone was unified and everybody served in some fashion. At home or abroad, everybody had a job, and the war affected all of us. I was born in 1940. I grew up on an Army base, started life on an Army base. This generation is much more divided. Here is something that I've been deeply concerned about. We're here having lunch today. We'll go back to our offices or wherever we are, and we'll go home tonight. We'll have a great weekend. Nothing will be asked of us while this country is at war. We're at war in Iraq and in Afghanistan at this hour. And young working class kids, most of them with just high school educations, men and women, are out there and putting on Kevlar right now. Helmets and goggles, and they're getting into Humvees, and they're going off to an uncertain fate. And they volunteered for this duty, and they pay a high price, and they get modest wages. Their families are sitting at home, terrified the phone is going to ring or somebody's going to come knock at the door. And they're a separate universe from all of us. That's inappropriate. We all have to work harder, however you feel about the war, and there are good reasons not like what is going on, to even hate what is going on. There are other reasons to support the war. But wherever you are in that spectrum, we all have an obligation to our fellow citizens to let them know that we're there to help if we can, that we're there to be empathetic, and to be grateful for their service. I love coming into Atlanta Airport because it's still one of the few that has the big USO banner and welcome home troops. A lot of them are coming through here, going back to Fort Bragg or wherever it is. And there are some great, great foundations underway around the country to help these people. But here's a perfect example, I think, of the challenge before us. In Meredith's home county and mine in South Dakota, there was a historic National Guard outfit, fought in World War II, got summoned in the Iraq War, went over. And like National Guard outfits everywhere, the members were all first responders. They were the fire chiefs and the police chiefs and the telephone company manager, and the guy was a foreman in the little manufacturing plant. And they were gone a year. Yankton's got a population of 12,000. The county's got a population altogether of 18,000. Next county, there's somebody here from Tyndall, I know. Next county is even smaller, 5,000 or so. Three guys were killed. And one is permanently physically disabled and blind. That community will take care of that family for the rest of their lives. He'll get some VA help, but the obligation really falls on that working class town. And they're up for it. They're willing to do it. Now, there are two things about Yankton. One is that they think Meredith and I are going to move back any day now. And the other one is, if they need something, well, let's call Tom and Meredith and see if they can help us out, which we're always willing to do. I was actually aware of what was going on before I got the call, and so the publisher of the newspaper and I talked, and I said, we'll build the house for them. It turns out that this wonderful young family lived in a home that my dad had built. It was a small house in the north end of town, very great pride of my father's family. So I felt connected to him, even though I'd never met him. And he called me back the next day, and this is what I love about the middle part of America and working class communities, whether it's there or in the south or in the northeast or in the far west. He said, we've been talking about it. That's very generous. But he said, that's just not right. We need to be a part of that. So how about if you put up half the money and we match half the money? And then we're all involved. And I said, well, that, you know, makes me feel even better. So the house has been built. We got him a van that's handicapped equipped. But the point is that that community is connected, but under terrible circumstances. And the rest of us have to think about that. And then we have to think about when this war ends, what happens to those veterans when they come back? Do they get jobs? A lot of them, because of modern medicine, have survived, but they're terribly disabled. Bob Woodruff, who's my friend at ABC, has done a brilliant job of making that clear to everybody about what he was able to do to survive. And it's, that care is not available to everyone else. But that's my little sermon for today. Pardon me? Well, I think that they have to, I say to them constantly, the great thing about the 60s, wherever you were on that spectrum, whether you're on the far right or in the middle or whatever the cause, whether it was civil rights or feminism or anti-war or going to Vietnam, the 60s grew from the ground up. People stepped into the political arena and said, I want to be involved in my own destiny. We've kind of lost sight of it. You know, we're the virtual generation. We're on the keyboard a lot. We're on the BlackBerry a lot. And life is about getting your boots on the ground, getting your hands in the dirt, and spending nights in scary places if necessary, and having, in this immigrant nation, an idea that we can all move forward together in some fashion, how uneven it may be and how much we may disagree along the way. But we've always found ways to move forward. The South is a perfect example of that. There are enough people in this room who remember what it was like in the early 1960s. The bitterness and the violence and the attitudes that this shall not change. Segregation now, segregation forever. But it did change. I had a heartening moment a couple of weeks ago. I have friends at Ole Miss. One of them graduated as my age, left the school, vowed never to go back because of racial policies, now is an endowed chair of in the journalism department. And I was down at the football game in Oxford as they were putting up not much of a fight against LSU. And we were in the chancellor's suite at the game. And my friend, Curtis Wilkie, famous political reporter from the Boston Globe, brought over this young woman who was a star student. And so we started chatting, and I said, well, what do you do next year? And she said, I'm going to go to graduate school. And I said, oh, where? And she said, I'd only go to Ole Miss. This is family. And just then, her mother walked up and said, oh, we would only have our daughter go to Ole Miss. I mean, we're so comfortable with this. We're so proud of this school. There are two African-American women. The mother is the president of the Ole Miss Alumni Association. That's one great marker about the changes that have occurred and where we're going from there. I get asked that a lot. And the question is, who's the most interesting person I've ever interviewed? And I get asked that a lot, obviously. And I've got a pretty good roster. I was the first person to ever interview a general secretary of the Communist Party. His name was Mikhail Gorbachev. That was a memorable interview. There are others along the way. Everybody from Dr. King to Ronald Reagan, from Margaret Thatcher to Golda Meir. In the sports world, I spent the summer of 1973 with Hank Aaron, and we did a documentary called The Long Winter of Hank Aaron as he got ready to hit the big home run. But the documentary that we did was about the hate mail that he was getting and the unalloyed racist comments and the threats on his life. And that was, Hank was a shy man, as you know, and still is in a lot of ways, but he opened up to me in an interview that we ran this summer on ESPN. You know, I've gotten to know lots of famous people in other fields. One of my closest friends and skiing buddy is Bob Redford. I've known him for a long time. Our families are kind of intertwined. Actually, the only person in the world to have interviewed Jane Fonda sitting beside her father, Henry Fonda. But all those interviews pale in comparison to the little people that I've met along the way. And I say little people by people who are ordinary, who are doing the right thing for the right reasons and not asking for celebrity. I've often used the story of a young woman in America's Georgia in 1965 or 66 when America's was going up. Pickups were lined the streets. Any member of the Negro community, as it was called then, the march, faced a death threat. The community got together at the end of the street, small black church, long meeting, doors open around midnight. This beautiful young woman comes out, and I said, "What are you going to do?" And she said, "I'm going to march." And I said, "My God, aren't you terrified?" She said, "Absolutely terrified." I said, "Well, why are you going to march?" She said, "I have no choice." And she did. And those kinds of people changed life. When I left Nightly News, I said, "That's it, guys. No more sleeping bags, you know, and no more overnight flights to hellish places." And 3 months later, I was in Pakistan, Kashmir, living in a cargo container with an earthquake relief team. And I woke up about 5 in the morning and went out to get a cup of coffee, and this young man from South Carolina followed me out. And we started chatting. And it turns out we'd had similar college experiences. We got 4-year degrees on the 6-year plan. And I said, "How long have you been here?" And he said, "Oh, I've been living in this cargo container now for, 7 months, I guess." He said, "It's the best part of my life ever." He said, "I'm out there in these villages every day where they have nothing. No running water, no health facilities, no homes, no education. And we're putting their lives back together." And he said, "If I do nothing else in my life, I've done this. And I can always know that I've helped my fellow man in some fashion." I run into these kinds of stories all over the world. And they are the ones who are the most memorable and most interesting.
One more question. When Dan Rather was here earlier this year, he mentioned how the news moves fast between stories and there's a lack of investigative journalism. Do you agree? And if so, what issues do you see that are under the radar that should be changed?
Well, you know, and the print press still does a much better job than we do on the investigative front. We have Lisa Myers, who's dedicated full-time to investigative reporting, and I always have said, Don McClellan, a famous investigative reporter here on WSB for many years, and I used to say, you know, Don, all reporting should be investigative. You're investigating to find out what went wrong and not just holding up a mirror and reflecting what you're seeing. I do worry that in our electronic side, that there is so much demand on our correspondents that they don't have time to make the extra phone call or to say, wait a minute, I've got to do some more work on this, more due diligence, got to track some things down. When I was White House correspondent during Watergate, I'd get off the air at 7 o'clock at night, and I'd be on the Today Show almost every day the next morning, but I could use between 7 and 10 to make calls. Now, when David Gregory finishes a report for Brian Williams, they hit a switch, and he's on MSNBC with Chris Matthews or with Keith Olbermann. And so it's a lot more frantic now, and we need to work harder on that component. I don't want to be the old geezer. I don't know how many of you ever saw the film About Schmidt with Jack Nicholson. Remember the retirement party? About 3 days later, he's in his old office saying, "Can I help you out with anything here?" So I go up and down the halls of NBC saying, "I'm not Jack Nicholson. I'm not going there." But they've been kind enough to ask me to keep track of what's going on, to stand back and to help out. These are, in many ways, my children. These are the young people that I brought into the system when we all grew up together. And the one thing I say to them is that it's become too lemming-like. Story pops up, everybody chases the same story all day long. And they do that in part because they have these voracious appetites and they've got to fill them up. They also do it in part because when you've got Paris Hilton coming out of jail, or Anna Nicole Smith, or a car chase in L.A., God help us, the ratings go up. So I always say to audiences who begin to complain about it, you've got a part in this. This is a compact. It's not just us, it's also you. You've got to be more aggressive and more selective as a viewer. I have a funny little tool in my house. It's called a remote control. Mine has an off button on it. It also has a channel switcher on it. You might want to try that sometime if you're not happy with what you're seeing. I'm a tough consumer of news. I click even when I'm watching our guys. If they're not doing what I'd like to see, I go find somebody else. I'm such a wonk, I watch C-SPAN on Saturday nights. I mean, I'm a really exciting date for my wife on Saturday night. Last question. Thank you all very much.
Tom, thank you so much for coming today. The Press Club would like to show our appreciation by making a donation to your favorite charity. And we hope to see you all again at our next Newsmaker Luncheon. That'll be on December 12th with Chewett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A. And we'll have Mayor Shirley Franklin on January 10th and Dr. Carl Patton on January 31st. Thanks for coming.